Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a program about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today we're very pleased to be talking with public knowledge advocate John Walensky, until recently professor of literacy and technology at the University of British Columbia, and now professor of education at Stanford University. John is going to be talking with us by telephone about his book entitled The Access Principle, The Case for Open Access to Research and Scholarship, published in 2006 by MIT. Hello, John.
Hello, Thomas.
Those of us who work in libraries and in the information business know that there's a kind of low-grade war going on, generally overlooked by the media and not often a matter of public awareness, in which important public interests are at stake. On one side of the conflict, we have monopolistic publishers, some of them massive international conglomerates, and of course their lobbyists, essentially pirating what is mostly publicly funded information and research in order to exact obscene profits from the diminishing numbers of elite academic institutions that can afford their fees for accessing this research. And on the other side, we have advocates of what has come to be known as the open access movement, who are working not merely to restore sanity to the circulation of knowledge among scholars, but to widen access to this knowledge to the general citizen, what Walt Whitman described in his Democratic Vistas as a kind of cultural democracy. And especially since the publication of your book, you've become known as one of the champions of open access. And although we've talked on our program about the open access movement in the past in connection with the Federal Research Public Access Act, I'm wondering if you could refresh us a bit about the economics of the traditional model of academic journal publishing and what's gone wrong with it before we go on to talk about open access as an alternative model for communicating knowledge.
Okay, Thomas. Well, to briefly encapsulate 300 or 400 years of history, the journals really began in the 17th century with a notion of presenting papers, of providing a wider readership for papers that were presented, in fact, in front of, in the English language case, in front of the Royal Society. Mm-hmm. They were never intended to be a source of profit. They weren't being distributed on the same basis that novels or other forms of literature were being distributed as a source of income, for example, for the author. They were really seen as a means of increasing the dissemination of ideas. Mm-hmm. And so that is at the core, and still in some senses the same basis, same economic basis for the distribution today. It's almost as if the author is turning to the publisher for a service rather than a revenue stream. Mm-hmm. The publishers, however, and again the publishing world and scholarly work is roughly divided between the commercial publishers like Elsevier and Taylor and Francis and Springer, and the scholarly societies, the American Educational Research Association, the American Medical Association. And so the journals in that environment have for a long time peacefully coexisted, if you like, and have competed some. The commercial publishers after the Second World War were a little quicker to respond, a little more flexible around introducing new titles. Mm-hmm. But what they also realized, the commercial publishers that is, this was a wonderfully stable market. The libraries could subscribe year after year. There wasn't that terrible process of churn, as they call it in the magazine business, of having to win back subscribers every year. And they also realized that they had a form of monopoly in the sense that it wasn't Time Magazine versus Newsweek. It was brain research versus neurological sciences. But brain research was really had a monopoly on those papers. Uh-huh. And no one else was publishing them or covering the particular, if you like, research or story that that research was telling. And so what happened, again, to run roughshod over this history, is that a huge discrepancy, that the commercial publishers took advantage of this economic situation, and were soon in a situation by the end of the 20th century where they were charging many times more on a per-page basis, many times more than the nonprofit scholarly societies for their journals. And they were also acquiring, buying up other publishers, taking over society journals, uh-huh. and getting a much larger market share. So by the close of the 20th century, we have a situation where libraries have been canceling subscriptions for a decade or two because they're in the face of increasing subscription prices, an inability for library budgets to keep up with the what was very often well ahead of inflation price increases, and put us in a situation where during this boom of a knowledge economy in the latter part of the 20th century, the libraries, the university libraries, the research libraries, were in a position of losing their hold, as it were, yeah. on the amount of knowledge, the amount of access to knowledge that they were able to provide faculty and students.
Interestingly, although with digital text we live in an age when information should be cheaper to deliver, the cost of academic journals has actually gone up at twice the rate of healthcare costs over the past 20 years. And just to give an idea of how much subscription costs have skyrocketed, a social science journal like World Development, which cost about $250 in 1997, now costs about $1,900 a year. And four-figure prices have become the rule rather than the exception in the sciences and social sciences. The International Journal of Educational Research costs about $1,300 a year, social science and medicine $2,500 a year, and many essential titles at the top of this list cost many times these amounts, with Brain Research, a neuroscience journal, costing over $21,000 per year. So how do academic publishers justify these costs, and what exactly do these publishers do for their money?
Well, let me just give you some sense of the escalation. Brain Research is actually at $26,000.
Oh, it's at $26,000 since the last time
we looked. Last year's figures.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the justification and the things we need to take into account are some of these journals are quarterly and some of them are published every month.
Yeah.
So there may be some quantity, but Ted Bergstrom's done studies on a per-page basis and finds that against the nonprofits, there's a 5 or 6 or 7 times uptake, if you like, or increase in the difference in the price between the two. The publishers, of course, are very happy to describe the laborious work and intricate processes they enter into. They manage the peer review, they do copy editing, they do proofreading, they publish it. Mm-hmm. And I totally agree that they do maintain very sophisticated, well-positioned websites for the material that enables you to navigate easily, find citations, and search through materials. So the issue really, for me, is that there are value-added services and that the publishers do have a role to play. When the publishers do this defense, they don't talk about the actual cost. They talk about the fact that they add value, which doesn't really justify this difference in prices. So we now have 3,000 or 4,000 journals that are open access and free. We have journals that are being published by nonprofit societies at a fairly reasonable rate, typically under $1,000. And we have what is now, in some areas, science, technology, and medicine, over 50% of the journals are published by commercial publishers, where those prices can enter into five figures.
The academics who write for these journals don't really get paid much for them, do they?
Not at all.
Nor oftentimes do the academics who sit on the editorial boards.
No, and the reviewers. Don't forget, the critical element and distinguishing element is the review process, the peer review process. So there is a contribution of labor. I mean, technically you could say the university is covering the cost of the review of some of the editorship, and certainly editors get some support from their institution. And the authors. And so if you think about the number of public institutions, if you think about the amount of public federally funded grant money involved, these are all highly subsidized processes. And the only commercial aspect then is introduced with this publication process, the managing of the peer review, the overseeing of the copy editing. And of course, many people will tell you that that copy editing process doesn't always remove errors, it may do the opposite, and the sense of distribution and advertising. And again, I think it's a failure to recognize that the internet has changed all of that. It hasn't changed the copy editing, but the distribution and advertising, the role of Google Scholar, for example, in terms of indexes, has radically altered the sense in which advertising is a meaningful process with the discovery of research.
Yeah. So you mentioned the open access journals. Can you talk about open access and what you call the access principle?
Yeah, so I mean, open access is a term that was adopted in about 2001 as a phrase or a way of identifying scholarship, particularly journal articles, that are free to read. Open access was the title choice, and it has a nice correspondence with open source software, which is a well-established movement. But what it refers to exactly, is an increase in access to knowledge. Because open access has its definitions associated with it that refer to immediate and complete free access. But it's often the case that we get access after 6 months after publication. We get access after the author pays a fee. We get access after an author puts it into an archive. And so I've moved back from the notion of strict dogmatic definitions of open access. And
yes, there are a variety of open access publication models, aren't there?
Well, there are two issues. There's very different economic models, and I'd be happy to talk about that. But even in the basis of access, there are different models, if you like. But I would refer to them more as a sense of a kind of continuum rather than distinct models, and that is, with the archive, you get the final draft of the author. With the New England Journal of Medicine, you get the article 6 months after it's published. And what I want to bring people back to is the basic principle, not an argument about what is really open access and what is free access, for example, but the principle that we need to be concerned about increasing access of any sort, and that any increase in access is a contribution to the circulation of knowledge and therefore to the quality of that knowledge. So when Elsevier first started putting its abstracts online for free, I took that as an increase in access, mm-hmm. even though it had nothing to do with open access per se, and even though it was very much an advertising, a cataloging kind of move on the part of Elsevier,
yeah.
it still made a contribution. And the commercial publishers today are experimenting, mm-hmm. Scrambling, you might say, for economic models that will open the literature further. The economic implications of that for libraries and for faculty members is interesting. Springer is charging $3,000 for an author to make their article immediately open access on publication. And for most of the disciplines in the academy, that's just out of the question.
Yeah. Though some academies now they're realizing how much money is going out through the library to pay for these subscriptions. So they're starting to subsidize scholars for this kind of publication.
And that is true, Thomas, absolutely. Both grants, you can now build into many of the medical grants, provision of funds for covering the author fees. And institutions are also setting aside money to cover what used to be page charges. I mean, this isn't a foreign concept, but are now called author fees. But again, this skews the question slightly because most of the open access journals do not charge author
yeah.
fees. And that it's particularly in the biomedical field, a group like Biomed Central with about 180 journals, uses an author fee basis. But that's only one of the economic models, and in some ways, because of the money involved, it is the most promising for publishers because they think they can recoup, you know, just shift the revenue from subscriptions to fees, mm-hmm. Author fees. But it doesn't bear on most of the academy.
Most faculty, I know, in any case, aren't rushing out to publish their material on open access, though the numbers are getting better. Do you think it will take more than simply offering open access titles as a publication option to move faculty over to sustainable models of communication? Or should institutions simply refuse to purchase overpriced titles or not provide credit to faculty who choose to publish in them?
It's not going to be an either-or in the sense that there have to be multiple strategies. The most promising route, if you like, to open access right now is not the open access journal, though that's where I'm doing most of my work, but is with the archiving.
Yeah, institutional repositories.
That's right. So 62 or 65% of the journals today permit authors to post the final draft of their paper after it's been reviewed in an institutional repository or on their own website, for that matter. And the estimates are 15% or so of authors are taking advantage of this. I mean, the major publishers, Elsevier, Springer, are permitting this. Mm-hmm. And so in principle, the majority of the research, in fact, the vast majority of the research that is published in expensive or reasonably priced journals could be open access, at least in their final draft yeah. versions. So the author self-archiving, the author simply uploads the article with the publisher's permission. There's no copyright issues. It's within the rights of the author to do this. It's a very promising route, and we're now seeing mandates. That is, it's being required, this archiving, from a number of granting agencies. Uh-huh. In the United States, the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, has a request that you do this. And right now, before Congress, there is a bill that will mandate it.
Uh-huh.
So that is one avenue, and I think that needs to be greatly encouraged, and I think that universities need to do much more on celebrating, if you like, or at least highlighting the fact that faculty members are contributing their work to the public domain by archiving it wherever it's been published.
Yeah.
And at the same time, though, I think that universities need to support open access journals. And again, when you talk about authors not rushing to publish in open access journals, I still take the New England Journal of Medicine, which makes its work, after 6 months, all of its contents free.
Mm-hmm.
I take that as a step,
yeah.
a major step towards open access. And they haven't suffered at all in terms of people submitting work to them.
Yeah. Is legislation like the Federal Research Public Access Act, which seems to be stalled in the water, is the threat of legislation in any case being passed driving these seemingly voluntary moves on the part of publishers to allow for this kind of open access within their structures?
It's a kind of contradictory situation. The publishers, the majority of the publishers granted this permission.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to any legislative action.
Ah, that's interesting.
And are now vehemently fighting, lobbying, I should say.
To stop the legislation.
They are actively lobbying against the mandate.
Yeah.
So it's an odd situation where they said, yes, you can do this legally, you can archive, but no, we will not have it mandated. And part of that is because the response to the voluntary archiving was so low, In the case of the NIH, it was 4% of the articles which they requested as a result of NIH funding to be posted in PubMed Central in an open access archive. Only 4% of the articles were being placed there.
Yeah.
And so I guess the publishers were very comfortable granting a right that nobody was taking advantage of, and they're very resistant of the notion that it will be mandated, and therefore a number of surveys have established that the authors would fall in line in a moment.
Yeah, exactly.
And the difficult part for us in the movement in open access, advocating for open access, is what happens when you put your work into an open access archive or on your website or in an open access journal, is the readership, not surprisingly, goes up.
Yeah.
And not only the readership, but the number of times you get cited, how often you are quoted, which is really a measure of reputation, goes up. And it can go up by a factor of, 30 or 40 or 50%, but it can also go up by a factor of 3, that's 300% increase in citations of your work. So there is an incentive there that just hasn't been fully realized, and maybe we're a little impatient in thinking that this should sweep the field in a matter of a few years.
Is the idea of open access publishing a kind of natural consequence of the development of the internet, apart from being driven by this crisis in journal publishing?
Yes, it is a coinciding of those two things. If there hadn't been in the 90s, 1990s, if there hadn't been a crisis in journal publishing around pricing, mm-hmm. then those people who began to experiment with putting their work up online and realizing that they could get, I mean, they realized two things. One, it was easy to put your work up online, but what was amazing to many folks was the kind of response and engagement you got.
Yeah.
You would submit an article to a journal, and you wouldn't hear back on the reviews for 6 months. In that period of time, you would have hundreds of interactions with people around your work, and it would begin to circulate, and you would be in a position to improve it and add to it. So in the 90s, there was two aspects. One was there was a crisis and a decline. And this is, again, as I say, the kind of oddity. There was a decline in our access to intellectual work through the number of subscriptions that had to be canceled in research libraries. And at the same time, people discovered this amazing medium that could distribute and create a more interactive engagement with this knowledge, and that it could be shaped as a journal. I mean, it didn't start that way, but people realized that if you could put papers up online, well, you could put a whole journal up online. The publishers, at first, of course, thought the world was print forever, but then quickly jumped onto that bandwagon and did put all of their journals, and the vast majority of journals are online, but they rolled over their economic model and sometimes charged more for print plus online access. And so we had, as it were, this kind of insurgence, a movement that established there was another way of doing things. And then we had what turned out to be even a stronger knowledge lockdown, as the work that was online, the access was restricted to a greater degree by passwords.
Yeah.
People had trouble going into libraries, and where they could take the magazines, the journals off the shelves, they couldn't just sit down at a terminal and see them.
Yeah. And of course, some publishers see the internet as a way to increase the cost of access by bundling materials now, where you can't buy the 10 journals you want without buying 50 more titles that you really probably don't want.
And this is an interesting element, because what we've seen is through the 90s, we had a declining access to journal titles because of the subscription prices. And since the turn of the century, many libraries have greatly increased the number of titles, but they've lost control to a degree on the titles that they purchase. And they're into no cancellation policies with the publishers, and they're locked in. And it's squeezing out smaller and independent journals. I think it's really has a lot to do with the nature of academic freedom, in the sense that the library budgets are being gobbled up by these major publishers, and the way that new ideas form around new journals is being restricted.
Now, I'm, of course, a librarian, and we've been looking at this problem of journal publishing as a matter of a problem for library budgets and access within the academy. But one of the things I find really exciting about your book is that you see the present situation as an opportunity to benefit people outside the walls of academia in all walks of life, and not just indirectly through more informed academic research, but by drawing people from other walks of life, including amateur scholars, into these discourses. And you root this perception, as I understand you, in the fundamental phenomenon of knowing itself. So can you talk about this and about the right to know?
I am a very big advocate of the right to know, and it goes back to my roots as a school teacher. I mean, I started my career teaching school and very much involved in public education, and I'm now a professor of education at the School of Education at Stanford, and still very much committed to this notion of education as a lifelong pursuit, as education as a basic fundamental right. I mean, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights recognizes that, and I'm right there with them. So that aspect of the right to know is something that we foster in schools from the earliest age, and the fact that the public schools in particular, well, I am at a private university, but the public schools in particular and the public libraries, take a sort of complementary institution, have been very much committed to that sense of access to knowledge. So the continuity with the open access movement is to say that the universities are producing knowledge to such an extent, and that even private universities are tax exempt because of their contribution to the public good, there should be, as it were, an increase, considerable increase in access to knowledge with the onset of the internet, and that there is something fundamental in people, not that they have to prove that they're able to wade through any article or that they have, as it were, to earn the right to this knowledge. I think it is a fundamental right.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm very encouraged and somewhat, you know, I had to say I was surprised, for example, with the uptake of medical research. Understandably, by families that have sick members or people who are concerned about their own health, of course, there's a sense in which this access to this knowledge is part of a rising public expectation that I have a right to know what is known. And it can take very personal aspects in terms of health, but it can also take a kind of basic human curiosity. And I use the example of astronomy, where there is a very large amateur participation. I mean, and again, I don't want to exaggerate that, but the amount of data being gathered by amateurs, the number of times in which amateurs are participating in the publishing of new work in astronomy, particularly based on observations, all of that seems to me to speak to a larger public education, not in the sense of schools, but public education in the sense of a public sphere, of a sense of a new kind of engagement. And the rise of Wikipedia is a very good example of that. And in fact, one of my big interests is trying to connect more of this open access research to Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. And to blogging, I expect, also.
Another very strong example of people engaging politically, intellectually, in a very informed way. And I think that the isolation of the academy, and again, I think it's not that the academy is moving away. It's being left behind, in a sense, that once publishing an article in Brain Research was to make it public. People were accused of not making their work public by keeping it in their labs. Well, they put it in a journal. But today, that's not the standard of making something public.
That's very interesting. There are several arguments that some profiteering publishers use against open access publishing. One that I find rather comic is the age-old argument that formal scholarly research is only for the eyes of the elect, and that the great unwashed shouldn't have access to it lest they do themselves harm by diagnosing their own medical ills, for instance. Do you have any thoughts about that?
You need to match that with the other complaint, and that is that on the web you can't trust anything.
Yeah.
And that's true to a certain extent, but the fact that we keep so much of the rigorously reviewed research from freely circulating on the web ensures that the quality of knowledge on the web is more often dubious than not.
That's interesting.
And the dangers of self-diagnosis, given what's on the web right now, I think is more profound than having good research available. Now, what happens with that good research in the case of medicine, for example, and self-diagnosis, is you have very interesting discussions and debates between doctors and patients. You have, as it were, I think, the democratic transformation. Let us go back to Walt Whitman's Democratic Vistas. You have a democratic transformation within the community. That is, when the doctor's office, when a patient says, well, what about this research and what about this study? And doctors do complain that they're spending more time talking to patients about the diagnosis and the background research that applies to their condition. And I, as an educator, and I, as some supporter of democratic relationships, say yes, that is better than the tyranny of expertise.
Yeah. Another related argument, a bit more subtle, is that the ordinary person, you know, what you mentioned in the book Samuel Johnson called the common reader, won't want to read the latest issue of the Journal of Econometrics, for instance, and that there essentially isn't a demand, a public demand, for access to this research on any scale.
Well, again, and I don't think that's a requirement. When you have a human right, you don't need to prove that you have a particular interest at that moment in exercising it. Samuel Johnson would have been reading the journals of botany, certainly for Scotland and other areas of northern Great Britain, had a wide range of interests that would have touched potentially on lexicography, on literary theory. So I don't want to underestimate. I want to think about, for example, high schools, community colleges, amateur groups, and again, go back to the roots. The first journal in English, the first academic journal, Philosophical Transactions, was started by the Royal Society, which was essentially a group of amateur scientists, experimental scientists. There were academics involved, and they invited Newton in, who eventually became president. But it was a lovely mix of those. And again, it wasn't a mix in terms of social class, unfortunately, but it was a mix in terms of professional and amateur interests in these areas. So the potential contribution of amateurs on the one side, and I think that is a very small factor, but the aspect of just human curiosity being occasionally addressed, that Wikipedia is the number one information site on the web today, suggests that people are interested in a wide range of topics and ideas, and they may rarely follow those ideas through to the level of reading the latest research. But if their child's education is at stake, if they're concerned about social welfare policies in their community, if they have a problem or a health issue that they want to look into, I think there shouldn't be a price barrier to access to knowledge that has been federally funded, that is being produced by tax-exempt, if not public, institutions.
And so, apart from the human rights argument, there's also the economic argument here, isn't there, that this research is, for the most part, being funded by public tax dollars, and quite a few tax dollars, to the tune of $28 billion alone from the National Institutes of Health annually for medical research.
Tax dollars and tax-exempt dollars. Yeah. The foundations are major funders in this. Private institutions, nonprofit research institutes, universities, public institutions. So there is a very strong claim economically beyond the human rights. But there's also an epistemological claim. I mean, I think we need to balance all of these, and that is the epistemological claim is very basically that knowledge that doesn't circulate has no claim, no substantial claim to being knowledge. In the sense that it hasn't been subject to review and critique. It hasn't had, as it were, a kind of thorough reading. Mm-hmm. And open access is public access, but open access is also universal access for scholars around the world. And we have a global academic community today, but we don't have global participation, both in publishing, but also in review and the scrutiny that work receives. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is an aspect around the quality of knowledge that argues for greater access.
People who read your book, whom I've talked to, always find especially interesting the way you talk about the historical context of open access in your discussion of public education societies of various kinds, especially in England, beginning in the 17th century with the coffee house culture, and then the rise of mutual aid societies and working class scientific clubs, etc. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about these, because they are so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who's been a public school teacher and who's worked in the schools essentially his whole life, I tend to put the school first. But the truth of the matter is that the library, the public library, came before the schools as a movement in the 19th century, mm-hmm. and that the public library was preceded by worker libraries and by, in fact, the coffee house culture. So the coffee houses in the 17th, 18th century were referred to as penny universities, and they were seen as a major center for the distribution of information, for knowledge, and that you would pay a penny, pence for a cup of coffee, and that you would have access to, you know, the latest publications, periodicals for the day. And in that sense, this interest in knowledge, I think we tend to underestimate. We tend to see it as part of a educational process, as part of credentials. But I want to come back to a historical continuity around a larger expression and interest in learning, a human curiosity that we think is very basic. So I do try to bring to the fore and take comfort and encouragement from a number of movements, from the miners in Wales to the public libraries in New England, to see that, in fact, this has always been, and again, I think it needs to be clear, this has always been a basic human aspect, but it's also been a struggle. It has taken sacrifice to put those miners' libraries together, mm-hmm. to collect dues and to bring together enough money to buy a shelf full of books. The public library movement is another good example. There were many struggles over establishing public libraries and concerns about who controlled them and what would it mean to provide what kind of material to people. So there is within us a tendency to see that the knowledge is dangerous, mm-hmm. A tendency to realize that, in fact, learning isn't always predictable and the results of learning aren't always predictable. So in this way, the open access movement is part of a longer struggle, and we tend to see everything as kind of now. The publishers are very happy to treat open access as an upstart, as an ill-informed, naive notion of what scholarly publishing could be. And what I want to argue is that this is just an ongoing notion of a historical movement and an increasing democratization of access to knowledge that has very strong historical roots and that shouldn't end with the onset of a promising medium like the Internet.
Yeah, you have an interesting passage in the book drawing on Stillman Drake that at the last great revolution of intellectual technology, the Gutenberg Revolution, the universities were not great champions of the printing press, but that it was the European public who drove and were impacted most by the distribution of information, and especially scientific and mathematical information, afforded by the printed book.
Yeah, and again, I think credit has to be given that that was very much market-driven, mm-hmm. that it wasn't, as it were, a free access movement at the time. But relative to what had existed prior, that is, the manuscript culture was a very restricted and a very expensive proposition.
Yeah.
And so that, to take the access principle again, print radically increased access to knowledge. It wasn't free, but again, the knowledge we're talking about online is not free. You still need access to a computer and internet access, so there has to be a library or there has to be a community resource or a personal resource in order to access it. So it's never free. And so what publishers discovered, and again, to all credit to the entrepreneurial spirit of the 16th and 17th century, what they discovered was there was a much larger market than had been predicted or had been realized, and that in fact the medium itself, that is the publishing, created a kind of educational milieu, added to literacy mm-hmm. and to the need and interest in literacy, drove part of this interest. So it's not simply a matter of people's curiosity. The level of interest today can be easily predicted.
Yeah.
It is that the availability itself leads to an increase.
That's a very interesting principle to keep in mind in all of this, that access can generate curiosity and interest. Thinking about other media in the context of what you have to say about the history of print, I remember when there was a genuine expectation that television was going to have a serious role in public education, starting with instructional programming in the 1950s that continued with mostly academic UHF programming in the 1960s. And although public and cable television have since been a great disappointment in this regard, I wonder if there isn't some hope for video yet as it moves into the interactive environment of the internet with evolving services like YouTube.
Yes, I think one of the critiques and one of the limitations of my approach is that I'm so focused on the academic journal. And it is, you know, certainly not the only means of learning or of even developments in knowledge, per se. That, in fact, the journal itself is a kind of artifact of print.
Yeah.
I am focused on, let me just say, first of all, the journal, because it is a particular point of frustration, a particular point of opportunity, let's be positive about this, a particular point of opportunity in terms of increasing access to knowledge. But at the same time, there are developments in multimedia around access to knowledge and learning that are happening, and you've mentioned the blog, and I've mentioned the wiki, and now we're talking about video. So the possibilities, and again, within the university and within the research library community, we're seeing open science notebook kinds of approaches, open data movements, and so there is a greater openness around a variety of different forms.
Yeah.
The contribution of the scholarly blog, the ability to comment, the Institute for the Future of the Book has developed a comment press so that books can be, there can be an interactive engagement in the very development of books. So there is going to be a new forms.
Mm-hmm.
The medium is not just the message, but it is in fact shapes the message and reshapes. And so the journal is an artifact of print. I'm working particularly on its reform, but I can imagine in, you know, at some period down the road, it will go the way of all things. But what won't change, I hope, is this increasing trajectory in which this access principle, this notion of greater access to knowledge and the greater circulation of knowledge, will only increase.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book there was a time when prominent academics would go on public lecture speaking tours. In the town I'm from, Mount Pleasant, Michigan, there was some memory there still of Ralph Waldo Emerson having come to lecture at the local college. And, you know, now with podcasting, you see hundreds of lectures being posted daily. So, you know, it seems to me a kind of continuation of this or a rebirth of this. Another really fascinating facet of your book is your chapter on reading, where you state that if open access is a public good, the question here is how can journals do more to help people enjoy that good? And this is where you talk about the design or the redesign of the reading environment. And I wonder if you could say a few words about this, because I found it very interesting.
Yeah, as an open access advocate and as someone who has designed software for journals to publish or to manage the journals and to publish with, I feel a responsibility that we can't simply just put the articles up on the web and expect entire public uptake. It would be like handing out journals on a bus, not thinking it was a waste of paper.
Yeah.
And so we're looking at, as part of this software design, question. We're looking at how to redesign the reading environment, because open access is public access, but also how we can create a more educational environment for graduate students, for scholars who are reading somewhat out of their own field. I mean, the very ideas that we want to encourage. And we're using a notion of reading tools, but the real principle here goes back to my work as a professor of education, as someone who works in the field of literacy, in which we could, if I could boil down my entire career to two phrases or two ideas, we know very well that the two motivating aspects or the two principles of reading are that someone needs an incentive, needs a reason to read, mm-hmm. and someone needs background or context in which to place that reading. And so we have people with incentive and motive for reading health research, medical research, but the missing component is the background and context. So the hypothesis we're working on is that if we design an environment for a research article, a reading environment for a research article, that provides part of that missing context, part of that background on an article-by-article basis, then we can potentially extend people's ability to critically, well, I would say to first of all comprehend, and then critically evaluate, and then utilize or take advantage of the knowledge that they're acquiring.
Yeah.
So to give you an example, the tools that we're working on, we're calling them reading tools. They come up with each article in the journal system that we've developed. We don't publish the journals, but people, 1,000 journals, in fact, are now using Open Journal Systems, the software we developed. In Open Journal Systems, when an article comes up, when someone selects an article to read, in the right-hand margin are a series of reading tools, and it allows the reader, for example, to click on any word, and it goes to a free online dictionary and gives a definition of that word. We try to take advantage of open access resources because we know a good number of the readers won't have access to a research library to tap into, but we also try to build in basic principles of reading research. For example, we have a button, a reading tool called Related Studies. Mm-hmm. You click on it and up come the keywords that the author has entered for their article and a number of databases that you can search that we've selected that are carefully aligned with the subject field of the journal. And you see the latest research then in these databases and can compare it to the article you're reading. So before you take it into the doctor's office, you find that in fact there are four or five subsequent articles that support the article that you found. You also see the ideas discussed in the article that you found discussed in different contexts by different authors. And what we know about vocabulary development is that if you see a concept discussed in multiple ways and in different contexts, your understanding of it is much more solid and secure.
Oh, interesting.
We also have a chance to look at the author's other works, a reading tool that shows you what else this author has done in that field, how strong, for example, their reputation is or their standing in the field. But we also want to break out of the notion of that academic silo, that is, that mm-hmm. research only relates to other research. So we have a reading tool called Government Policy. It allows you to search on the keywords of that article in government databases. In the United States, the FirstGov is a wonderful site to search, and we have built in a little script that allows you to search for policies around medical or health issues, political issues, educational, legal issues. And so you can begin to see, and again, even though the article may be 5 or 6 years old or 1 or 2 years old, the database, of course, is right up to date and allows you to position that knowledge within a larger context. Similarly with the media, I was very delighted the New York Times is now grants 20 years of access. It used to be 7 days free access. So you could search 20 years, potentially, of the New York Times on articles bearing on what you're reading about in that article, that very sophisticated research article. You could see it discussed in the public media. So by building this larger context, by guiding readers using Boolean searches, mm-hmm. using sophisticated databases, and we've chosen at least most of them are open access databases that provide full text, and some of them are restricted. We are doing, as it were, a kind of experiment. The book itself is a wonderful literacy device, a mechanism for reading with its index, its footnotes, its table of contents. But we think there's something else that can go on in the online environment. So again, going back to my roots as a researcher in the field of education, we're exploring this notion of a reading environment that enables people to extend and read far beyond what might otherwise be predicted, if you like, by their reading level, but also allows a kind of engagement of this knowledge that brings this knowledge itself into a larger public sphere of government policies, media reports. We also have an instructional reading tool as well to see how ideas are being taught and to support, for example, faculty members interested in teaching the concepts in an article. Yeah. So it's a way of integrating and extending the public and educational impact of the work that's being published.
Yeah. That sounds very exciting, especially given the fact that what we have now in most online reading environments is simply an electronic approximation of the printed page, where if you are looking at a PDF, you probably are using either Preview or Adobe Acrobat, which means the only interactivity you have available is perhaps the tool that emulates a yellow highlighter and another that lets you paste in a word or two, but there really aren't even any proper glossing features, even to match those afforded by the venerable note card.
And the annotation, I think, is a very, very important aspect, and we're seeing some very interesting developments. I mentioned the Institute for the Future of the Book has created a comment press where you can comment paragraph by paragraph. For us, the target for this year, if you like, is to have a complete annotation, both a private one for personal study, but also a public one. Show me the comments of other people, what hyperlinks people have added to their text to see, you know, to connect to related work.
Yeah.
And that's, for us, the target for this year.
So can you give us a picture of the kind of ideal you have in mind, the sort of thing you dream about when you think about open access and the open access movement, if the movement were really to help propel a new age of knowing?
I think at this point, I mean, I try to limit my dreams to the immediate.
Well, here I want you to go for broke.
Let's start with the notion that we have established a viable alternative.
Yeah.
That we have enabled people to make some choices. I mean, the commercial publishers are not going to go away. And in some sense, I'm not asking them to.
No.
I think that there is a place for a market, if you like.
Yeah, no, at one time they were partners in the process before they became parasites, before many of them did anyway.
And I appreciate your candor, Thomas. And I mean, it is, again, going back to the early days of printing in the 16th century, the universities, very few of them, the Cambridge is a good example, worked very closely and would loan money to printers, but also worked very hard to maintain what they considered to be fair prices. So there is a very interesting relationship that we've somehow lost a hold on. But today, the need is a sense of alternatives or a way of publishing that restores control to the academy, that enables very basic principles of academic freedom, of new ideas to form, and not simply to establish themselves within a very commercial marketplace. And the aspect of that, for me at least, is the sense of the evolution of the journal itself to a much more open and flexible format, so that we see not just the journal article, but we can work with the evolution of ideas. We can start from the, if you like, the mythical back of the napkin notion of a formation of an idea, perhaps the blog is the best analogy to that, and have people engage with these ideas through the whole process to the point of publication and formal review and part of that. And again, I do agree that the journals act as the record of science and form a very important historical aspect. But the idea that everything else is invisible and closed until the journal publishes, I think, is something that will change.
Yeah.
So this vision of the future is not simply that all knowledge will be free. It is that, in fact, the whole engagement with ideas will open.
Yeah.
And that the process, and I keep going back to history, but the founding of the journals in the 17th century was based on a move from the correspondence, from people sharing letters in which their basic ideas, their back of the, I don't think napkin would be appropriate in the 17th century, but the basic ideas would form through a correspondence, and that the publication of them would be presented at a meeting. And that became more formalized with the introduction of print and the journal. And so I think, again, this process of exchange, and again, it goes on in email, it goes on through those kinds of exchanges in laboratories, becomes a more open process.
Yeah.
Now, what that will mean in terms of what happens to knowledge, and will it be the end of standards and peer review as we know it? I don't think so.
No.
I think there's still a very strong place for formal, rigorous review. And I think there is a place for a point of publication rather than a continuous revision and the kind of state of fluidity among documents or around research results.
Yeah.
I think there's still a point for that. But I think there's room for, and again, the multimedia elements that you introduced earlier, Thomas, are an important aspect of that. But an opening that extends well beyond just the particular point of publication.
I know every group has dreams of, you know, making society over into its own image. But looking at the big picture here, and especially reading your book with its emphasis on public education, I sometimes wonder if we could be moving towards something like a society of scholars, toward a kind of Hegelian refinement of the collective psyche fueled by these technologies that enhance what scholarship is all about. That is, basically knowing, and if knowing isn't one of the most basic characteristics of what it means to be human, I don't know what is.
And I want to be cautious about that too. You're right, this making the world over in our own image. I am working from within an academic life, and I'm only asking from my perspective. I mean, I think there is, I would call it a revitalized public sphere at this point that the academy is not fully part of, and that this Wikipedia phenomena, the blogosphere, the listservs, and again, it can be coffee geek, it can be around very basic notions of just consumer review. I think that there's a far stronger contribution that the university could make. Not that the world becomes a world of little scholars, at least thinking of children or of academics, but that the ivory tower isolation, which has been changing. Emerson goes to Mount Pleasant, Michigan. There's no reason why the New England Journal of Medicine, and in fact has, made its work available to every small town and community, wherever there's an internet drop.
Yeah.
So the prospect of the contribution, I think we can change. And again, I think there's a very strong political element here. And again, with due appreciation to Emerson and Whitman,
yeah.
That the democratic quality of this knowledge, I think John Dewey should be on the table as well,
yeah.
In this discussion. I mean, John Dewey's notion of a democratic culture, and John Dewey actually experimented with a research newspaper in Michigan.
Oh, that's interesting.
It was a failed economic experiment, not surprisingly. But that idea then of increasing the democratic quality, and I think particularly the notion of a deliberative democracy, that is, a democracy that is based on a thorough discussion of the ideas, not always rational and not always a fair process in terms of the best idea wins. I think it should be very clear that from my perspective at least, that research is only one of the elements that enters into any kind of deliberation,
yeah.
And that research should not be in a position where the research will decide any aspect of civil life. But the idea that we are producing this research and it's not available to inform deliberations is the point of my concern.
Yeah, sure. Political democracy depends on cultural democracy.
But the quality of that democracy, and in particular, if you like, the informed quality of that democracy, is an issue. And again, as an educator, it is not always the results that are so important, that is the democratic outcome, but that process of deliberation,
yeah.
And thoughtfulness of that process that adds to the quality of that society.
So I want to thank you, John, for joining us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, The Access Principle, The Case for Open Access to Research and Scholarship, published by MIT last year.
Well, thank you, Thomas. It's been a pleasure, and your questions have been provocative, and certainly you're, perhaps detect a slight sympathy for this notion of an access principle and increased access.
Oh, yes, yeah, definitely. It's been very interesting.